Osiris.
Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
I'm Iris DeMent. I'm in Iowa City, Iowa. I'm attempting to make the world a better place. I'm trying to place myself in the human community a little bit better. And music has a knack for that, wouldn't you say? The course and dream the dream.
Welcome back to the show On the Road, everybody. I am your sonic spelunker, Zach Lupitan. Thank you for diving through the caves and the mountain streams of sound with me. This week, as you're hearing, we talk to the amazing Iris DeMent. And as she sings on How Long, which is featured on her new record, like Martin Luther King Jr. said in his 1963 March on Washington, I Have a Dream speech, we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I really did learn a lot talking to Iris, and she's been releasing poetic protest albums since the early 90s, starting with her iconic 1992 John Prine-endorsed debut album, Infamous Angel, and her fiery, politically charged The Way I Should from 1996, which was nominated for a Grammy. She never holds back what she really thinks. After six pent-up years of working on her new record, Working on a World, it's finally here this week. And this time, she wants to honor the luminaries like Mahalia Jackson, John Lewis, Martin Luther King Jr., and even the Chicks, a.k.a. the Dixie Chicks, who stood up and put their principles and lives on the line to help bend history towards progress and righteousness. Now, of course, Iris and many folk singers before her despair at the thought that music alone cannot move history in the right direction. What does it mean to be on the right side of history? If you have about 6.5 minutes, stop what you're doing and listen to her seething protest song, Going Down to Sing in Texas. It's not just about gun control and about the tyranny that is sprouting all around us. It's really honoring the people who dare to speak out and put their reputation and their necks on the line. In Texas, they actually loosened gun laws to make it easier for anyone to have a gun in any place at any time, right after mass shootings in El Paso and Odessa took the lives of over 30 people. And while Iris has been confronting this lunacy in her songs for over 30 years, she chuckles at the thought that many folks only know her as the playful duet partner of her longtime sonic soulmate, John Prine. In spite of ourselves, maybe one of the most fun-loving, dirty-mouth love songs of the 20th century. But I urge you to dive a little deeper with Iris. And we're going to dive real deep right now. Okay, here she is, Iris Dement. Well, I feel like we've forgotten as music listeners and song consumers that protest music is a part of the American discourse, something that is deeply ingrained in, I think, the bedrock of what American music is.
I like how you put that. Mm-hmm.
And this new record, Working on a World, which comes out as we speak next week, very exciting. You know, you're diving into the stories of obviously Martin Luther King Jr., Mahalia Jackson, John Lewis, social justice warriors that had to push this huge rock up a endless hill. Do you feel like as a songwriter who's been working, you know, 30 plus years, that you are also pushing a rock in a similar way, or is it a totally different practice?
Well, I feel like just to live to an extent, something involves pushing a rock, you know? I mean, life, even the best of circumstances, you know, it requires a lot of us. So there's that to start with. But certainly gathering the will and the determination to make this record involved that for me, because there was a period of time, you know, around, started, I guess, late the year in 2016, like so many people that, you know, we're tuned in, and yeah, I had to dig down deep, muster up something to keep me going, and I poured all of that into these songs. And
the title track, you know, has this refrain that, you know, I don't have all the answers to the troubles of the day, neither did all our ancestors, and they persevered anyway, right? Mm-hmm. I think the hardest thing to recognize as fellow artists or something who are trying to bend the arc of progress the right way, mm-hmm, is that there is this constant backslide. There's two steps forward, one huge step back. Mm-hmm. I don't have all the answers to the troubles of the day, but neither did all our ancestors. They persevered anyway. When I see a little baby.
Well, my first record came out in 92, but in 96, I think it was, around the Bush era, yes, I put out an album that had some political songs, Wasteland of the Free, and There's a Wall in Washington. And yeah, that's when that turn was taken.
I mean, not saying that it doesn't take, well, I am saying that it does take some courage to be openly political as a songwriter who's trying to sell music. I mean, you had those records on more or less major labels, you know, in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Was there pushback when you tried to be openly political in your songs that early?
No. I had surprisingly little, if any, pushback in the years of my record making, even with, for the last few records, I've put my records out on my own label. But prior to that, as you said, I was on Rounder and then Warner Brothers. And it's not what you would expect, but I had a team of people around me that totally supported me in doing what I wanted to do. And I had made that clear when I went with them, and they abided by their commitment. All those people are fired. I don't think any of them,
God rest him,
are there anymore. The rest of them left. They saw the writing on the wall and left. But, and then, you know, I got out of there. But no, I'm fortunate that I could say that never got in my way, or maybe not fortunate, I don't know. But I wrote the songs I wanted to write, and I put out, you know, records the way that I wanted them to be. And
could you imagine the way I should, that record released in 96, having a song like Wasteland of the Free coming out on some sort of major label now? I can't imagine it, you know.
Are there any major labels? I don't even. I am so out of the label. That was an honest question. I really don't know. I just don't pay attention. There are a few. Okay. Yeah, you know, it is odd. You might be right about that. I mean, certainly wouldn't come out on any major, like, you know, pop or country records. But how odd it is, though, that at the same time, these major labels are more than willing to put out records that say horrific things about women. I mean, really violent. But you're probably right, that song.
I mean, you start right
coming after them, you know.
We got politicians running races on corporate cash. Now don't tell me they don't turn around and kiss them people's ass. You may call me old fashioned, that don't fit my picture of a true democracy. It feels like I am living in the wasteland of the free.
I mean, right in the opening lines of that song, Wasteland of Free, we're talking about these preachers, you know, that saying they are Christ's disciples, they don't look like Jesus to me. They're living in the wasteland of the free, you know, and they're talking about corporate cash in church. I mean, right, again, but I don't see Carrie Underwood.
Oh, no.
People who are on American Idol as the new face of country, right? They're not talking about preachers stealing people's monies, dealing in these dark politics. It's unfortunate because I think a lot of country music actually started as protest music.
Well, I mean, it's not just the record industry, it's the entire country. It's all been driven now towards profit and profit for the very few. And it seems to me, what decisions are left that aren't made on that basis? You know, whether it's art or cars or you name it, the list is so long. Journalism, you know, the damage from that is incalculable. Corporate-controlled media outlets, you're correct, they're not going to be playing songs like this.
We put these little kids behind prison doors. We call ourselves the advanced civilization. That sounds like crap to me. Feels like I am living in the
Well, you grew up in Arkansas, one of...
No, I grew up in California. I was born in Arkansas. Yeah, that's my true. Family yes. Went to California when I was very little, yeah.
Youngest of 14, is that right?
I am, mm-hmm.
Which creates its own drama, I'm sure, growing up. But the Pentecostal upbringing you had informs your work to this day.
Yes.
There is a fascination, I think, with this figure as both social justice warrior and token of deceit that can be used by people in power.
Yeah, you get into another highly troubling area. I think if you were to ask me what I'm most concerned about today, maybe next to global warming, are, you know, white evangelicals. We could call them white nationalists, but I think and that would be accurate. But basically what they've been up to is the same today is what they've been up to for a really long time. They've just consolidated power and become really scary. Those folks keep me up at night. And having come out of that world, they're running the state I live in, you know. They gave us the last president. It's the fascist party now, and it's pretty terrifying, the level of power they have achieved. So I want to be clear that I came out of that world, but I left probably 90% of it behind. I'm very, I admire the teaching. I admire what we know of Jesus. I think he got placed in the wrong book. And I expect any day now the evangelicals will say as much because they're not very interested in that guy. He's a problem for them. If you notice that, they very, very rarely mention him anymore. He's a major complication, you know, a hitch in their agenda. But he, you know, like so many other wise prophets of our time, you know, in my opinion, was on to a pretty good thing. And I try to carry that through in my music. The other thing that I haven't let go of is, I don't know if I can even put words on it really, but there was something that I learned about in those churches. There was something, I just call it the spirit, and I don't feel the need to try to explain that. I don't think that's contained in anybody's religion. You can be an atheist and feel this thing I think of as spirit. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have anything to do with. But I was, and I give my parents a lot of credit for this. They were good, decent folks that were there for, I mean, to avoid talking about this all day, basically the right reasons. And I at a young age could pick up on that element of it. That soulful thing that mm-hmm. humans need to connect to. And I felt that when I was very tiny. And I when you say me maintaining my connection to that, I don't know what you're saying, but for me, it's that. I'm mm-hmm. trying to carry that into the world, minus the BS, and that's only grown.
Well, the song Let Me Be Your Jesus on the new record, which you know, you wrote with your husband, Greg Brown. There's this sort of sort of irony poking us. Don't believe what you hear. Don't believe what you see. Just listen to your savior now. Only believe in me, right? Like anyone strong arming you to only listen to one side can't really be a savior in a way.
You know, I would even, back to Jesus, I personally don't believe Jesus ever even said that. If you read, you know, we don't need to talk all day about Jesus. There's lots of other guys that were very interesting too. But I don't think that, you know, this whole, you know, no one gets to the Father except through me. I don't, a lot of those words just don't jive with, you know, the other things he said. And so I just, how'd I go with that? My husband wrote those lyrics. I wrote the melody, by the way. But again, as you know, there's a lot of folks like that. I mean, pretty much any fascist authoritarian mm-hmm. fellow, and sadly, they are always men so far, could come close to fitting that. It's the fascist leader description.
Let me be your Jesus. I'll lift you out of hell. Protect you from the heathen press.
I heard that the far right, I think Prime Minister of Italy, who's a lady right now, believes that the Lord of the Rings books are religious canon.
You know, I had forgotten about her. you know, when you, that touches on another thing. I mean, the to be raised biblically is essentially to be primed for conspiracy theories, to be raised with the belief in the ark and, you know, the angel rolled the stone away and, you know, the virgin was impregnated by God, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It goes on and on. I mean, I was taught stories about the man swallowed by the whale who had an encounter of God, popped out. I was taught these stories as facts. And even today, sometimes I feel myself, I'm still disentangling myself from that. Because when you are born and every grown-up around you is in support of, it's really, it's a lot to part. Oh, where was I going? My point was that it's a perfect marriage, the evangelical Christian, whether you're in Italy or here, community with what's going on right now. You're primed for conspiracy theories. So yes, whatever it was you said, the Prime Minister of Italy's, you know, it's not any more out there than Jesus walked on water, you know, and the Red Sea was parted. So
yeah, the trees started walking, you know.
They're perfect companions. And that's really what's so, I've always kept my mouth relatively shut about people's religions because I thought, well, that's your faith, you know. Mm-hmm. You're free to your faith, but I don't think we have that option anymore. I actually feel like it's my duty now to say out loud, these are myths and they're really, really dangerous to us. To just look the other way while tens of thousands of people are managing their lives, you know, and their view of the world based on fiction, that's a serious problem. You know what I mean? You've seen it here. We're in agreement, I assume. If not, let me talk some more.
Keep going. I think the vibe on this new record is one of paying homage or giving thanks or sort of being thankful that you can be in a world where a Martin Luther King Jr., a Mahalia Jackson, even the Chicks, also known as the Dixie Chicks back in the day, can exist among us, you know, and to put their necks on the line. And, you know, your epic going down to sing in Texas, which feels like would fit right on one of the new Bob Dylan records, you know, just going for it. But like, you know, sort of paying homage to these people, Merle Haggard, Willie Nelson, like those guys. Oh yeah. If they would have stuck up for what they believed in Texas.
And did.
Many yeah. Times. Who would have cared except that the Chicks did it. And then they get blackballed out of the industry for what, a decade almost, you know? It's striking. And you know, you've played in Texas for 30 years. Obviously you talked about the open carry law that got passed on there. And yeah, it's like, you see shootings and these things happen in music venues and churches and public squares all over the world. How are we to feel safe as people who don't agree with those policies when, you know, people can just walk in with guns on their hip at your show? You know?
Yeah, it's over. And that's what that song came out of in that tiny room, by the way, of seats about 100, 150. There's no getting out, you know? People are closer to me on that stage because I am to you, you know, 2 feet away tops. It was very sobering. There is no feeling safe, and it's no accident that there's no feeling safe.
I'm going down to sing in Texas where anybody can carry a gun. But we will all be so much safer there. The biggest lie under the sun. That's all she wrote. I'm going down to sing in Texas where anybody can carry a gun.
The people who come to see you at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, right? Mostly probably preaching to the choir, but are there times where you feel like someone has spoken up to you or heckled you or felt the need to disagree with you in a public way that made you uncomfortable?
Well, I've always had, I mean, pretty much from the day that I put out, you know, The Way I Should and started playing some of those songs live, absolutely, I would have people that would, you know, boo or sit down or invariably somebody would leave during that song or, you know, and I got a lot of hate mail, but that was pre-social media world and pre-Donald Trump and, you know, pre-having leadership directing people towards violence and hostility. Mm-hmm. So we're in a whole different, it's a totally different ballgame right now. So it would have never entered my mind that the level of danger that exists now for all of us, and as you said earlier, myself just as a folk singer, you know, a little club could face just by saying things to speak out of conscience, you know, speak from a place of conscience. You know, you would walk in the streets and confront, you know, you'd cross the Selma Bridge for something like that, you know.
Right.
And now it's crossed over to a whole different level. But yeah, that song for me was my decision to, I just have to make that commitment. It's not an option to, I just owe too much to the people that came before me and the people coming after me to just to go hide out. So to the best of my ability, I'll keep saying what I feel I need to say and things will go as they go, you know.
What's the deal with all these war criminals who get to walk around free? Like that president who lied about WMD. Hundreds of thousands of people are lying in their graves. Celebrities are calling him the sweet new friend they made. But what's the deal with all these war criminals out walking around free?
There's that verse in Going Down to Sing Texas. I know I'm just a pilgrim. I'm only passing through. It's a choice I'm making, trying to be true. I don't know if there's a judgment day or a master plan, but I want to be ready if before the Lord I stand. I think the idea of being this pilgrim, I mean, it's sort of the foundational myth of this country, right? Like these people who came to stand up for something they believe in, right? Except that those people then oppressed other people, you know, and then like then people fought against that thing, and then those people came in power, and you know, it's like this again, the swinging back and forth of, you know, the Puritans or whatever who felt this righteous need to have freedom in this country, and then slave owners writing the Declaration of Independence. You know, there's this foundational irony in this country, you know, right to the root.
Yeah, we kind of have that everywhere. I'm sure if I dug around much, I'd find some foundational irony within myself that I'm not aware of and don't want to know about. But you're right. But the thing that I think it's important to remember, if you probably, you know, I'm not saying that you haven't, but I remind myself of when I get discouraged that things are such a mess and what I'm doing is just a drop in the bucket, which it is. I remember, you know, what's kept the whole thing from going all the way to crap, going back to the Puritans and 1,000, was that not everybody was doing that. There was always this percentage of folks that were countering that stuff. They may not be written a rap about in large, you know, numbers in history, but those people have always been there and working on bending that arc. And so when I get discouraged, which is most hours of most days, I remind myself of that. You know, all of us have to stay in there pushing back however we can. And that's folks that have done that in the past is why you and I are here talking right now, right?
Right.
We're free to do this right now. It's not an accident. It's because some folks stood up and didn't go, you know, hide off in the corner. That's our job now.
Not sure if the Show on the Road podcast would thrive in Russia right now, but, you know, who knows? I feel like what you and John Prine, who obviously you worked with many times over your career, have given the world, I think, is the idea that I think the working people, the people in small towns who come from humble beginnings have humanity and a power to them, that these stories matter, you know. I mean, the first song supposedly you ever fully wrote, Our Town, is maybe your most beloved and listened to song, right? Does that feel strange all these years later? That song has had such lasting impact.
Yeah, you know, you just, you know, I don't remember thinking past that moment really when I wrote that song. But you said my first song. So I wrote two songs the first week I started writing songs. I wrote two before Our Town, and I played one of them for my brother, and he said, "Oh, that's so and so's song." So I
scratched
that off the list like that. I had no consciousness, but I was like, "Oh, this one's great." Well, yeah, it was, and it wasn't mine. The other one I don't remember, and then Our Town came. So it really was, but it really was my first song. But I had wanted and been praying and hoping and trying to figure out how to get a song for, you know, a decade or more before that. So, but as far as something coming together, you know, it was that song. And I as soon as I wrote that song, and it came really, really fast, it was a spiritual moment for me. I felt like somebody walked in the room and said, "Iris, this is what you're going to do." Mm-hmm. And I'd been wondering since I was like 10 what I was going to do. And I was 30, I think, when I was I 30. No, I was 25,
I think.
When I wrote that. Thanks.
Let me just fill you in on your own history here.
More often, right? It was 25. So I didn't think, oh boy, I wrote a hit. That never occurred to me. What I thought was, I'm going to be a songwriter. And that seals that deal. And at that point, I didn't know how to play guitar. I didn't even know how to play the chords to the song. So I had a lot of figuring out to do. But I was absolutely assured that's what I was going to do. There was nothing that was going to stop me. And, you know, I haven't lost that.
Well, go on now and kiss it goodbye. But hold on to your lover, cause your heart's bound to die. Go on. Sleep up the street beside the pretty brick wall. I bring them flowers about every day, but I just gotta cry when I think what they'd say if they could see how the sun's setting fast. And just like they say, nothing good ever lasts. We'll go on now and kiss it goodbye, but hold on to your lover, cause your heart's bound.
And your dream of creating the closing credits of Northern Exposure and CBS finally came true, you know?
Well, I, it wasn't actually my dream. I'd never seen this show. I was out working like all days of the year when Northern Exposure was on, and I had heard about it, not seen it. And then of course I saw it when they played my song there, and that was, they beautifully placed that, and that has helped me a lot. A lot of people became, between John Prine and Northern Exposure, Nancy Griffith, little boost from Merle Haggard, I managed to survive doing this. You know, I don't play big rooms. I don't sell records. Of course, now nobody sells records. You give your records away. Speaking of the corruption that should have our hair standing up on all of our heads. it has mine. You can't see it, but my hair is standing up on the inside. I'm really.
You mean you're not wealthy from the 10 million streams that Our Town has on Spotify right now?
Do you know it would take 120 million streams for me to just pay for what my record has cost me so far? 120 million. But the guy, let's see, the Apple guy, let's just start with him. And they're the better payers of all. But the fellow who owns Apple, he made something like $99.4 million last year, and some $750 million, you know, stock buyout, whatever all their 8,000 ways of getting rich are. And that guy can't pay me more than 0.001 cents. We should all just be out of our minds with rage, you know, that we ran to the you know, to vote every year. I did put my check in the box, you know, and those people went up there and they did this to me. These are the results of laws, right? These aren't just like weird little odd, oh, how can it, you know, it's not a coincidence that we can be, that I'm, and all artists are in this position now of giving their goods away.
Well, I think there's this double-edged sword of the beauty of the digital music discovery ecosystem, right? Mm-hmm. Which I benefit from every day. I could lie to you and say that I don't use Spotify all day, which I do, to find a lot of new artists that I play on my radio show or the podcast. And yet my own songwriting, you know, and my touring band, which has probably, I think, 15 million streams on Spotify,
that's
can barely get by.
Yeah.
Right. And that's just like a fact financially,
yeah.
You know. Now, I think what people aren't talking about is that the playlisting world, right, it's passive listening, right? It's stuff that it's just on in the background. It's something that you cursory glance at. that people who are really devoted to an Iris DeMent record will find you and support you. It's just like, I think we have to manage our expectations a lot more with the massive amount of art that is allowed to be in the world. And it's good that the art is allowed to be in the world, but it's also so much harder to find the people who are already working in the world, you know?
Yeah. There's a lot of layers to this, but I want to see the 1% start managing their expectations. You know, Touché. We're always asked to manage our expectations, yeah, yeah. Working people, you know, right. Oh, no, you don't deserve a paid sick day. Oh, you don't deserve healthcare. Right. You know, enough of that. But yeah, I mean, I'm not anti-streaming. I'm anti, you know, corruption. And it's like,
well, it's like, why does the CEO of the company that is putting the music out need to make 100 million where we make 30,000? Like, it's, you know, it's like, can there be some leveling of the score without being like communism? You know, it's like, there's a tough balance to walk there.
Phone and the brain. Yeah, I mean, they're buying the education system. You see what's going on with DeSantis, and that's going to spread, you know, if you get control of the educational system, and you just, I think Hitler figured that out too, didn't he? Like, educate the young, and then you won't have protesters in the street. They won't have heard the stories. They won't know the history enough to counter you. And that's the direction we're headed really fast here. But
obviously you're
why
very...
I thought I had to make this record. I probably should stop talking to you and get to work on the next one, because there's a lot of work to be done.
Well, you talk about obviously education and as a way, obviously, to lift people's consciousness. Is it true that you dropped out of high school and
I did,
moved to Midwest? I mean, like, that must have been obviously a whole journey, but like, your education came from the places you worked, the people you met, right? Which kind of filters into your songs.
Well, largely, you know, I made it through the 10th grade, and then I left and I took the exam for the GED and somehow passed that. And then I went later on, some years later, I was probably 23. I went back to school for about a year and a half. And I'm glad I did. I was ready and enjoyed that. In fact, I'm not sure I would have started writing had it not been for the teacher, my English literature, English 101, who really, really encouraged me. Prior to that, I didn't know I had any talent. I'd wanted to be a writer when I was a kid, but I didn't ever get encouraged. And I also thought, if you can believe it, I came from such a sexist world that I thought, well, I'm a girl. Boys are supposed to write. It seems crazy now, but those messages were really powerful in my world. But yeah, I went back, and this English literature teacher was so encouraging. She would tell me I had good, interesting ideas, and I just went with it. You know, next thing you know, I was writing songs, and I had faith that maybe I had something to say. And then I couldn't stop.
And you released a record, The Trackless Woods, in 2015. Mm-hmm. Based on Russian poet Anna.
No, some people say Akhmatova, and then I've had some Russian people say it's Akhmatova, but then I've heard some of them say Tova too, so I don't know. And my daughter's Russian, and her last name is, her birth name was Chesnikova, and they most definitely said Ova, so I'm a little not sure myself, but I've decided to go with the Akhmatova.
How did you discover the work of that poet and want to devote yourself to that album?
That originated with my daughter. My husband and I adopted our daughter when she was almost 6 from Siberia. She's almost 24 now. So, I mean, that was the entrance, you know, just being very interested in her and her culture and trying to understand, you know, the world that formed her a little bit better. And then somebody had given me a book of poetry. It was a collection of poetry. In fact, it's sitting on my desk back there, a little book. Russian poets. And anyhow, one day, I after having that book for two years possibly, I opened it up. It was sitting on the piano, and I opened it up, and I don't know, I just have had a number of these experiences in my life, and I opened it to Anna's poem, Like a White Stone, and I read through it. I don't remember having any particular feeling about it, but It was kind of like when Arataka came to me, I felt somebody watching the room said, set that to music. And I said, I don't know how. And they said, I'll help you. And, you know, 5 minutes later, I had that song, White Stone. And that's how that project went.
Like a white stone, deep in a dry well lying. His heart and clear memory lies in me. I could not strive.
You know, I don't know what these things are, and I don't have some big mystical, I don't really even care anymore what the explanations are. But I do know I have things like that happen that feel rock solid real, and I trust them and I go with them. And so far I've never been directed to do anything that was harmful to anyone. So I'm like, well, okay, let's write some songs together. You know, whatever, whoever you are. And that's how that proceeded. So I didn't know anything about her. And I just locked in and couldn't stop. And I think I took about a year off because I thought, well, this is insane. I have no business setting a Russian poet's songs, you know, to melody. What do I know about that? And I just couldn't stay away. And I kept coming back to it. And 18 songs later, there it is, Trackless Woods, which very few people bought. I don't care. My husband's favorite record.
The ancient gods changed men to things, but left them a consciousness that smoldered endlessly.
Have you ever visited Russia?
I went there 2 times. Blake, that was the poet. He made a record of Blake songs, and it's amazing and beautiful. Out of print. I'm like, it's just one of the best records I've ever heard. I went there 2 times to visit my daughter the first time, and then the second time my husband and I went together to actually adopt her. So we were in Moscow for a little while in the dead of winter, and Siberia, it's hard to say a little town, not a particularly little town, but a pretty beat down mining town in Kamarovo. I would call it like central Siberia, getting, yeah, pretty, maybe a couple hundred miles north of the southern border. And you know, a lot of beautiful, amazing people like there are everywhere that were struggling and bearing up under really, even then, really difficult circumstances. There are warriors of love everywhere. My daughter had a foster mom who was one of them, and no one will ever know her name, but she had virtually no resources and worked at an orphanage, devoted her life to that and taking care of little children. My daughter was one of them. And
it's a perfect segue into your song Warriors of Love off the new record.
About her.
These figures that I think we know, like John Lewis or Rachel Corey, but people like this person who saved your daughter from ruin in a way are equally,
well, definitely in her case,
powerful, you know.
I try to, you know, one reason I wrote this record and some of those songs you're referencing, I mean, talking to you and thinking this, I just felt my spirit brighten up because I needed to dwell on these kinds of people to get me through all of the, I'm trying to think of words that are, you can say in public about the characters we've been dealing with for a long time now, but John Lewis, I mean, somewhere, I remember the former president said some god awful. Like, how can any living, you know, anybody with any sort of soul or heart or eyes for that matter, say something like that? And I remember make a little note to myself, I have to write a song about John Lewis. And I'd been wanting to write a song about Rachel Corrie for a long time too. And I remember when she, I think I heard about her on, I know I did, on Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman's show, Democracy Now!, years ago. And yeah, you know, you just make little notes in your head for things that you feel you need to pursue and do. And then the time became right and they wound up in that song together.
John Lewis stood on the Betty's Bridge. His life, he was ready to kill, to break the bond.
I mean, all the women in Iran right now who are, you know, sticking up for, you know, some their freedom and their and they're just getting disappeared and killed in the street. I think it's hard to believe that something like that can keep happening in this time of, you know, we assume progress and prosperity. And but the world is so vast, right, that our, you know, relative safe existence in Iowa City or L.A., it's so different than what people are going through in different parts of the country. And we get these little glimpses through the peephole of time, you know, the internet, Twitter, you know, it's like these little glimpses. And then all of a sudden it's shut out and we move on to whatever other thing is happening. We haven't talked about Iran in the news in weeks, months, maybe, you know, it's like we've already forgotten about it, you know. Like what happened to these
women?
Yeah,
it's not an accident we've forgotten, because you know, the news cycle works that way. You know, it's, again, as you know, it's also geared towards profit. It's not profitable to stay with something until it gets corrected or addressed, you know. And like you were talking about the women of Iran, I mean, we gotta step up for these folks, you know. We may not be able to go over there and change their situation, but we can carry the mission and carry the commitment to righteousness, you know, to cut to the chase and justice. We can carry that in, you know, endless ways. You know, Vera with my daughter, that's how she did it. I'm doing it through my songs. You're doing it through your work and your band and whatever things, other things in your life you're involved in. It's so easy to get discouraged and feel like that doesn't matter. I do it all the time. I was discouraged yesterday. I'm like, throw my record out the window. I can't change. You know, I can't solve the big problems. I get like that. But all of us together can maybe not be able to turn around, but we can keep it from falling down.
But I think the funny thing also is that many people may only know you initially from something like In Spite of Ourselves with John, which is such a lighthearted kind of little smirk of a song where you're talking about, you know, him getting turned on by sniffing your undies, right?
Yeah.
And we're like, yeah, that's Iris DeMent. That's what I know her from. She's the lady talking about undies with John Prine.
This is true.
That's her. That's what I know her from.
Yeah, I didn't see that one coming. John,
it's
also
a great song.
John also wrote Sam Stone, you know, which I'm sure you know. But we change. I remember when that call came through. John had just survived cancer.
Mm-hmm.
John told me he never thought he was gonna die, but a lot of the rest of us, you know, were concerned. And for good reason. I don't know how much you know, but he lost half his neck and he was possibly never going to sing again and so forth. But anyhow, he called me after that and asked me if I would record that song with him that he had just written. And I'm just, of course, you know, it was like John back from the dead. I would always say yes to John, but especially a back from the dead John. It's like, and he kept saying, I think you share the lyrics. I think you share the lyrics. I'm like, John, I'll sing anything with you.
She thinks all my jokes are corny. Convict movies make her horny. She likes ketchup on her scrambled eggs. Swears like a sailor when she shaves her legs. She takes a licking and keeps on ticking. I'm never gonna let her go.
Got more balls than a big brass monkey. He's a whacked out weirdo and a love bug junkie. Sly as a fox, crazy as a loon. Payday comes and he's a howling at the moon. But he's my baby, I don't mean maybe. Never gonna let him go.
In spite of ourselves.
His wife Fiona got on the phone. You have to let me fax you. That was faxed. And I'll be honest, I paused. I didn't like see my future holding like lyrics like that. Like, are you real? Is this for real? But we did it, and I would have not done that song with anybody but John. And then we went out and sang it, I don't know how many hundred times, and it's been great. I'm over that hurdle.
How did you first meet him, or how did he first John? Encounter your work?
Well, when I was making my first record, my friend Jim Rooney produced it, who co-produced this one. He was one of, counting me, there were four of us on this because it was never going to be a record. I just kept going in to record songs with people, right? And the next thing you know, it's like, wow, I got something that's looking like a record. So he and I did Infamous Angel together, and he had a demo of it, and he knew John, and nobody knew me. I had never even done a show. I had only stood up and sang like in front of like open mic people, you know, and sang like songs. So I had this record. So anyhow, he knew John. So he asked John if he'd listen to the demo, and if he liked it, would he say something? And so that's how that all started. John liked it. He cried into his pork chops and wrote a story about crying into his pork chops. And it did me a world of good. A lot of people listened to my record because he told them to. So, and then we continued almost immediately. He started taking me out to open for him. And I worked with John until, you know, till the end. I did a lot of tours with him. We recorded, I don't know, half dozen duets. Sang him every night, and I would go out and open for him even those last years a couple times a year, and that was a great loss to everyone.
I mean, you've been able to team up with some legendary folks, obviously, you know, Steve Earle, who I was able to talk to in this show as well, Amy Lou Harris, you co-wrote a song with Merle Haggard. Do you feel like your songwriting brain is different when you are collaborating with someone versus writing for yourself?
Yeah, I've done almost no collaboration. This is the first record. You know, my first husband, who's not musical at all, he says, I'm not putting words in his mouth. You know, we did the kind of thing in the car, you know, we might come up with a title together. And I've just not really co-written. And the song I did with Merle, I was out working with him, touring with him. I still can't quite believe it. He asked me to play the piano for him in The Strangers. So I went out and did that for 6 or 8 weeks, I guess. But while we were out there, I had a song, This Kind of Happy With You, but I didn't feel it was finished. And I came in on the bus and asked him if he would like to help me. He instantly had a bridge. So I think what I'm coming around to saying is I never had to sit in a room, you know, figure this out. But this record is different, though. I did co-write two songs with Pieta Brown. And those were more like maybe the traditional kind of co-writing that when we think of co-writing, we think of, I don't know, like, is there any traditional co-writing? But yeah, we were equally, you know, involved in both of those songs. So
The Sacred Now being one that you wrote with her.
Yep. And I Won't Ask You Why. Yeah, we did those together. And I don't think I've ever, I think that's it. I haven't co-written apart from that. So back to your question. I don't know what it is. You said at the beginning of the show, you know, the family of 14. And I think there's something in there for me. Like I've done my sharing here.
Yeah.
I just felt from the get-go with my songs, it would be my songs. I want this to be something that's me.
I traveled high, I traveled low, and there was no place that I didn't go, looking for this kind of happy. With you, I had a love, it wasn't right, and I spent so many lonely nights yearning for this kind of happy.
You feel like there was a show, a moment in time where you had like your biggest rock star moment, like the biggest audience, the most intense show that you can ever remember, where you're like, I can't believe I'm here.
A show? This wasn't actually my audience, but I'll take it, okay? It was Glastonbury. And oh, wow. The Glastonbury Festival, and I think it was 96, right around in there. I mean, it was just a sea of people as far as I could see, which really, honestly, that didn't do anything for me. I would rather see some, you know, a handful of people I can make out rather than the sea of people. But the high of that was Johnny Cash went on after me, and I stood in the wings. I still can't believe that happened. I stood like 10 feet away and I watched Johnny Cash and June Carter do their show, and I, you know, snapped photos. I don't know your history with Johnny Cash, but I mean I was a kid and Johnny Cash, he was just bigger than life and really touched me deeply, and there he was and I had played there. I didn't make any sense. So, I mean, again, that was not my audience. I'm sure a handful of folks were there to see me, but that was pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, it's epic.
But other than that, it could be any night. It could be a room. I've been in rooms with a spattering of people. I walk out and be like, oh, damn, nobody can, and had the most amazing time and felt like the universe just couldn't have gone on without that evening. That happens, and so I just stay ready for that at any time.
And someday when I draw my final breath, I'm gonna know that I had the best, 'cause I had this kind of happy with you.
Big thanks to Iris Dement for getting on the line with me. You can go to irisdement.com for her tour dates and her newest record, Working on a World, which just came out. She'll be playing starting in March in Louisiana and Texas, in Nebraska, Missouri, all over the place. So please check out her show. And if you're curious what my group Dust Bowl Revival is up to, well, we're going to be going to the East Coast at the end of March, starting March 22nd in Pittsburgh, a rare show over there at Thunderbird Music Hall, and then we'll be heading to Lancaster, PA, and Washington, D.C. at the Hamilton March 24th, playing in Annapolis, Maryland at Ramshead, and finishing up at Ardmore Music Hall in Philadelphia on the 26th. A lot of fun's coming your way. Please check it out, dustbowlrevival.com. As you might have heard from previous weeks, yes, I have a new radio show. 88.5 FM LA, the SoCal Sound, has my show, The Sway Out West Radio Hour, every Saturday at 7 a.m., or you can listen anytime on the archive page. If you like this show, you can donate. The Red Circle Donations app is on the iTunes text page. Please check that out. And you can subscribe on our website, theshowontheroad.com. As always, The Show on the Road is written, produced, and edited by yours truly, Zach Lupitin, and we are part of the BGS Podcast Network. Stay safe, stay creative, and we'll see you on the trail.
Hi, this is Henry Kay, host of the number one music history podcast, Rootsland. Come with me on a journey to Kingston, Jamaica, where we explore the world of reggae music and the untold stories of some of the genre's greatest legends. From the ghettos and tenement yards where the music was born, to the island's iconic recording studios. We are so excited to team up with Osiris Media, the leading storyteller in music, because as you'll hear, sometimes the story is the best song.